to given a title to this talk, which may ring some bells in the current situation. It's called Lying Cows and Buddha Nature. I came to this topic through two experiences that virtually coincided. One was when I rang Australia Post to check on something, and before I got connected with the service that they were providing, or that I wanted from them, I was treated to the following announcement, approximately, I'm not sure if I've got it right. All Australia Post employees have the right not to be subjected to any behavior or abuse that includes threats of physical harm or violence, religious, cultural, racist, homophobic, sexist, or other derogatory remarks. And of course, I was doing this at the same time when we've been heard that our defense minister referred to a complainant in an alleged rape case as a lying cow. So what does this say about us, this kind of language? And it's not restricted, obviously, to those places. Well, we often hear about how we are a polarized society, and that's certainly true, and how we lack a sense of personal respect for each other, which is certainly true. But I think at an even deeper level, it's a denial of our shared humanity. So what can we learn, or what are some things that I've learned anyway from a Zen approach to such things? We have a couple of kind of spot-on lines in some of our readings and sutras, two of which we read this morning. So Hakuen Zenji reminds us, all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. So it may be frozen water, but it's nonetheless water. And Suzuki Shunryo, one of whose books is well known, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is quoted by a current Soto Zen teacher as having said, to be a human being is to be a Buddha. Buddha nature is just another name for human nature, true human nature. That said, how do we account for the existence of abusive thoughts and behavior towards other people? Well, the idea of ice and water might suggest that our original nature has become frozen, you know, and we can't let it flow anymore. An analogy I like is not a Zen one, but goes back to Confucianism and to Confucius' probably best known follower, Mencius, who talks about human nature being like water, with not ice in this case, of water that has a tendency to flow downhill. He doesn't say, but elaborating on that, it seems to me there's also a suggestion we can make water flow uphill if we try hard enough, so we pump it or do something like that, so that our natural inclination may be to do good as water flows downhill. But that doesn't mean we're doing good all the time at all, that it gets dammed up, and we're hearing about horrible things about dams and rivers, you know, in New South Wales at the moment. So given the fact that even though we may have somewhere buried beneath all sorts of layers or frozen aspects of us, a Buddha nature, how do we, and other people, of course, as well. So how do we react? How do we deal with abusive behavior, first of all, by other people? One of the things we didn't read today that's in our book is a poem by Rumi called The Guest House, where he talks about uninvited guests just coming in, sort of trashing the place, and that we should be pretty patient with them. There may be a reason we can learn something for them. We should treat them well. We should treat them politely, no matter if they're trashing our place. In Torai Zenji's Bodhisattva Vow that we read this morning, he calls such abuse a compassionate device, something that may actually wake us up to something important. And there are stories, of course, of the Buddha's life, of the transformation of people who've abused him. There's a very famous one of the robber Angulimala, whose name evidently means necklace of fingers, because what he did was cut off the fingers of everybody he murdered. And I think it was 999 by the time he got to the Buddha. Anyway, it was pretty nasty fellow. But through an encounter, something like he sees Buddha and, oh, you know, all his riches. And finally says, you know, I've been looking for you. And the Buddha said, well, I've been looking for you too. And there, a sort of transformative moment occurs, and he becomes a follower. Something I really didn't know about and just happened on the other day in the Lotus Sutra, we're introduced to someone called the Never Disparaging Buddha, according to Thich Nhat Hanh's translation anyway. And Thich Nhat Hanh writes, whenever he met someone, he would address them very respectfully, saying, you are someone of great value. You're a future Buddha. I see this potential in you. And there's stories about how he was treated, not always received kindly for those comments. But of course, what is the sentiment behind that? So what does that mean? What does that suggest to us, perhaps, in our personal encounters with abuse and abusive language and behavior? We've touched on this before, I think. One possible avenue is to recite and be conscious of the metta or kindness meditation, in which we wish for other people what we wish for ourselves, and gradually expand that to someone who's calling us a lion cow, for instance. Perhaps picturing the abuser or the tormentor as having a Buddha inside him, so that somewhere, you know, after Adrian shouting at me, I somehow envision. I can't say that I've tried this. I'm just trying to think of possibilities that we might try. So I say, oh, somewhere in there, you know, I can see it if I look hard enough. Or my X-ray vision will find the Buddha within, despite his terrible behavior, you know, toward me. I recently came across something. It's a cute name called a commuting narrative, suggested by a practitioner and theorist of motivational interviewing, which goes as far as taking the idea of commuting. When we're going to work, someone cuts us off, all of a sudden we get really, really angry. You know, how dare he do that? He just, well, almost risked life and limb, and, you know, what kind of drivers are we allowing on the roads these days? And instead, constructing a completely fanciful narration. Oh, that poor guy. Look, just look at the tension on his face. I could see it in his neck and the back. He's late this morning. His daughter was up all night with an illness. He forgot to iron his shirt until he just was about out the door, and he's late for his meeting. They call this a commuting story. Trying to temper what might be a quick reaction on our part of something negative. And often in encounters, and I don't know if this happened with the Buddha and the necklace of fingers bandit, through a soft, positive move on our part, we can induce that or suggest that to other people through the mechanism known as mirror neurons, that often that's reciprocated if we can provide a more civilized response to the abuse. Now, how well these things will work with systemic racial or gender abuse is another question. I think I certainly want to return to that when we talk about the patience paramita, how we deal with anger in ourselves. But these are just suggestions that you may or may not want to try. One thing I've noticed, though, in the literature that I've encountered anyway, the Zen literature, is that there's very little said about abuse toward oneself. Now, I don't know how other people are, of course, but my personal self-talk is really nasty. If anyone could listen in to some of the names I call myself when I think I'm failing to do something, it gets, I wouldn't want to do it, I wouldn't want to print it, I wouldn't want to have it recorded. know, for this talk. But I'm really, really can be pretty, pretty harsh for no real reason. The things that aren't consequential, forgetting something. I forgot to turn off my phone, actually, before, you know, oh, it's going to ring right in the middle of this. And then sort of beat up a little bit. Oh, you stupid idiot, Tom, you should have turned off. Why didn't you do it at 9 o'clock? You know, that kind of thing. And so that can be quite personal nastiness to oneself. There, of course, is cultural or gendered self-talk about good girls or real men, you know, what we're supposed to do in the way that comes from our own past culturally or personally in terms of parents, for instance, or other authority figures. So I've been reading or rereading Magda Szymanski's biography. Her father's voice is behind her in so many ways. Certainly as a child, but even as she grew up, he's such a strong presence in her life. And I don't know what goes on in Donald Trump's mind. He's also, his dad, Fred, seems to have been a pretty nasty character. So what do we do with that? In a sense, that seems to me, well, I don't know if it's more difficult, but it's just something that isn't really addressed, I think, in the literature that I found. So I'm suggesting that kindness begins at home, that I suspect that the extent to which we genuinely relate to others with genuine patience and generosity correlates with the way we relate to ourselves. So not just outward behavior, the sort of goody-two-shoes kind of thing, but genuine way of, you know, treating ourselves decently. So only when we're comfortable and at ease with ourselves can we manifest that kind of behavior toward other people, or the extent to which we're comfortable with ourselves influences the extent to which we can genuinely and not just give lip service. Anya often talks about the near enemies of certain kinds of behavior. So you say all the right things, but it's not what's coming on inside. And of course we can get away with that an awful lot. So that we might start again with a meditation in which we're wishing for others. But just the first part. So, may I be safe and secure, may I be healthy and strong, may I be compassionate and wise, may I be free from suffering. And stop there for a while. Now, that's quite enough. You know, if we were all like that, the world would be a better place, I'm sure. And interestingly, Thich Nhat Hanh makes, it seems to me, a slight leap, and I don't know if that's present in other writings on the never-disparaging Buddha. He actually says, the function of the never-disparaging Buddha is to remove the feelings of worthlessness and low esteem in people, to encourage and empower people who feel this way, to remind them that they too have Buddha nature, they too are a wonder of life, and they too can achieve what a Buddha achieves. And of course, I'm also reminded of something, you know, in the Western Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition as well. Love thy neighbor as thyself. So it's until we can love ourselves appropriately, that can't be extended, as the suggestion is, to the neighbor. So the as thyself is often overlooked, and we're on the neighbor part rather than the self part. So what are some possible self-helps that suggest themselves? First of all, perhaps on a psychological level, to try to identify the source of any abusive voices toward oneself. So in Magda Szymanski's case, her father. Just as I was suggesting, using the opening part of the kindness verse, act as our own never-disparaging Buddha. Probably don't have to spell things out the way Thich Nhat Hanh says that the never-disparaging Buddha did. But create an image of our own inner Buddha. I was thinking up not too long ago, I had a pacemaker implant. Now, what if I could get a Buddha, a never disparaging Buddha implant, you know, in here and then. But it suggested something interesting to me, which may not work to other people. But as I do this, I sort of tap, I can feel it in here. And I wonder what happens if I can extend, if in a situation. So, well, this is sort of my never disparaging Buddha inside. There are probably many other creative ways that we can work with that. But basically, we should be treating ourselves well, trying to do unto ourselves as we would do unto the Buddha, if we treated ourselves as well as people we encountered as a Buddha, and with that same respect and love. I can't guarantee it, but if we try it, maybe the world will be a better place.